So here we are once again joined by our very own official from the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in this very particular week and that we are living through. We are on the verge of conclave. Conclave, of course, being the process to elect the next pope. We are right now in the hands of the College of Cardinals, who are leading the Universal Church and the Holy See. But all of this must seem quite foreign to the many people unfamiliar with the process of sede vacante, vacancy, conclave and papal elections. And that's why we have you here today, and that's what we're going to talk about. So question number one, can you take us through some elements of the process to elect a pope? Tell us, for instance, what the meaning of the term conclave is.
Well, Lima, the process to elect a pope is, as you rightly say, called a conclave. And the most important details about this great event are found in a document which was prepared by the late Pope John Paul II, and the name of that document is a Latin title, and it is Universi Dominici Gregis. And this great Latin title simply means the shepherd of the Lord's whole flock. And if you're interested in finding out more about the document, you can just put it into a search engine and you'll find it very easily on the internet. Just as an aside, what you often may not realise about titles of Vatican documents is that they're officially given in Latin, and the title of each document is very often taken from the opening words, the very first words of the text. So for that reason, if you look at the opening title, you get a really good kind of a summary of the most important elements that the document contains itself. So let's go back to what we were speaking about, the Universi Dominici Gregis. This is a particular type of document called an apostolic constitution, and the whole text deals with the procedures of electing a new pope and gives us details, in fact, of the role of the new pope. I'd just maybe quote the first two lines of the document for you. It says, "The shepherd of the Lord's whole flock is the bishop of the Church of Rome, where the blessed apostle Peter, by sovereign disposition of divine providence, offered to Christ the supreme witness of martyrdom by the shedding of his blood."
But what does that document actually have to say about conclave?
Well, going to the very substance of the document, we can say that it's essentially outlining the process involved in electing the pope that takes place in a gathering of cardinals, which is called a conclave. The word conclave might be familiar to us, but we might not know exactly where it comes from. In fact, it comes from a Latin word, two, in fact. It's a fusion of two words. The first word is cum, which means with, and clavis, and that means key. So when you put those two terms together, the conclave means a place that may be securely closed. And that's what happens at a conclave. In fact, there's a closed room or a hall which is especially set aside and prepared for the cardinals when they're there to elect the pope. And most of us know that this room in question is called the Sistine Chapel.
But can you tell us something about the history of conclaves? I mean, there's been quite a few episodes during the entire 2,000 years of the church, haven't there?
It's true. From recent experience, we're used to the idea that the process to select a pope takes place at a fairly swift pace. But this wasn't always the case. And so I'm going to bring you back on a quick journey back to the 13th century to see what happened there, because that had a great role in the structure of the conclave. In 1271, the election that in fact ended with the choice of Pope Gregory X as pope in the town of Viterbo, which is a town about an hour north of Rome, had not only lasted 9 months, but in fact it had lasted over 2 years and 9 months. And with this long delay, the local authorities, who were very weary of the huge protraction of this whole thing, they decided that they would close the cardinals and reduce the limits of their movement. And this enclosure of the electors, the cardinals who were electing the Pope, in fact had a great result because it actually hastened the outcome of the election, which was so long desired by many. And so from that time onwards, whenever a Pope died, the cardinals stipulated that they would wait for 10 days only for the absent cardinals, who of course weren't there for the funeral, to arrive in the place. And they then gathered in the palace where the Pope had died, or if that had been impossible, perhaps the nearest city, which wasn't under interdict, or in the bishop's house, or in some suitable place. And they all came into one room, a room which didn't have a partition or a hanging or a curtain, and they all lived in common. And this room, in fact, there were really two rooms to which they could actually go freely, were to be closed off to the public so that in no way could anybody hide or do something which was unobserved, and no one from the outside could speak to the cardinal, so they couldn't speak with anybody either. So now we get a really clear idea from history of the conclave as a locked room or as a secure space.
But it wasn't just their movement that was restricted, was it?
That's absolutely true. There were other restrictions as well, apart from movement. No cardinal, for example, might ever send out a message, either a written message or a spoken message. And that was under pain of excommunication, so a very severe penalty there. And there was to be a window through only which the food could be admitted. So it's all very tightly controlled. And then more restrictions. If there were 3 days that had passed and the cardinals hadn't arrived at a decision, they were to receive for the next 5 days only one dish at noon and their evening meal. And then if these 5 days elapsed and they didn't have an election, only bread and wine and water should be supplied. You can see that there's a kind of a diminishing nourishment graph taking place here. And during the election, they weren't to receive anything from the papal treasures. They got no money, and they weren't allowed to deal with any other business, which might, of course, distract them from electing the Pope. And then, if one cardinal neglected to enter, or if he left the enclosure for any reason other than sickness, then the election wasn't halted. In fact, it actually went on without him. But if his health was restored, he might re-enter the conclave and take up the business, but only at the point where he had found it.
To less extreme measures, this is filtered down to today. For example, we know that there is a mobile phone, tweeting, Facebooking, calling ban on all the cardinals once they enter the Sistine Chapel. Isn't that right?
But it's not just there. It's also in Santa Marta where they live, because they take out all the televisions, internet connections. They put up a jamming device to actually block all the signals. The cardinals are bussed from Santa Marta over to the Sistine Chapel, or if they walk, there are police there to ensure that they don't actually bump into somebody and, you know, maybe get the news from outside to see what they're saying. So it's almost like in lockdown. It's almost like a high security detail.
It's not like a holiday that perhaps many do imagine.
Oh no, and I'm sure they're very glad to do the whole thing very quickly and get on back to the business, especially cardinals who are diocesan archbishops in their own country. They have a lot of business waiting for them when they go back.
So we see that the conclave then and now is governed by stringent rules. Has that developed any further?
It is true. Initially, I suppose in history, not everybody was terribly much in favour of these rules. But overall, the immediate elections that followed these very stringent rules made the conclave sessions last a much shorter period. And so in theory, the idea was the tighter restrictions made for a shorter conclave and made for a more positive outcome. And in fact, the conclaves that followed actually one only lasted a day and the next one only lasted 7 days. So it really was very, very good.
And we saw this also in the 2005 conclave that elected Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, 24 hours.
Exactly. They had the morning mass on the Monday morning. They had two ballots in the afternoon. They had two ballots in the morning. And then by the afternoon of the Tuesday, Pope Benedict XVI had been elected.
So it really does focus the cardinals' attention, these rules.
Well, it's true, but also they have some time before the, which is what they're doing these days in the gatherings of the congregations, which we're going to talk about in a moment.
So once the College of Cardinals is convoked, all the cardinals come to Rome. But before they can go into conclave, there is a series of meetings, quite important, in which they have the opportunity to exchange views and discuss topics together. What are these called? They have a very specific name.
They do. As I come in and out of work these days, I see a group of journalists and cameramen gathered near the colonnades of St. Peter's Square, near a gate that leads to the audience hall, which is named after Pope Paul VI. And it's at that point, and of course in other places around St. Peter's as well, that the journalists are watching the cardinals as they come in for these famous meetings, which are known as congregations. And while the matters discussed in those congregations with the cardinals remains, of course, reserved, we can gather with a little bit of kind of intel that they're discussing among themselves all of the personal interventions that they're making and listening to each other, hearing what basically they think that the next pope is going to have to be like if he's going to face the challenges for the world in the years to come. And so you get these general themes like the church in the world at the moment, the needs of the evangelization, the Holy See, the relationship between the curia and the church, the different dicasteries then and the departments of the Roman Curia, and then also relations between local churches and the various different pastoral problems that they have. There are all these things are being discussed by the cardinals, and the end result of all of this is, as the Vatican spokesman noted there in a couple of days ago, is that he said the profile for the future pope is beginning to emerge. And usually these meetings take place twice a day, in the morning and then again in the afternoon. And it's during these sessions, as soon as all the cardinals have arrived, that they will then decide a date for the conclave.
And once a date is set, and we know the conclave is going to begin on that day, what actually happens?
Well, on the day of the first election, It's very beautiful because there's a mass in the morning in St. Peter's Basilica with all the cardinal electors and people who work in the curia very often are able to attend that mass too. In the afternoon then, the cardinals will enter the Sistine Chapel, and as they go in they'll see those beautiful frescoes, including the great fresco of creation there by Michelangelo on the ceiling and the Last Judgment, which is on the wall behind the altar. These are things that they'll have before them as they're praying and contemplating and making up their minds. They'll take their places then in seniority, and they'll make an oath to observe the strictest secrecy above all things about everything that occurs during the course of the entire conclave. And then before the first ballot, a specially chosen preacher will be there on hand to address them about the seriousness of their task and exhort them to, in the words of the document, to have their eyes fixed on God alone. And then they will experience the fact that the doors of the Sistine Chapel are locked with a key, and that's where they'll have the first ballot then on the afternoon of that day.
It's where also we hear the famous phrase extra omnes, which means
everybody outside, everybody leave.
Now, what can you tell us about another of the symbolic or the great symbols of conclave, which most people are probably familiar with, and that is the smoke that we see billowing out from the Sistine Chapel?
Exactly. Well, some visitors to Rome have often asked me in the past to point out the famous chimney that they've seen on television where the smoke billows out following the burning of the votes. And I have to ask them at this point to use their imagination and to look, though, towards the triangular-shaped roof, which is located on the right-hand side of St. Peter's Basilica, just below the level of the statues which stand atop of the basilica, and to sort of imagine a point about one-third way up from the bottom left-hand side, because that's where the workers in St. Peter's have to break through the tiles of St. Peter's, of the Sistine Chapel, and insert a chimney and run a flue all the way down to a furnace, which they locate on the apex wall of the back of the thing. And then people say, yeah, of course, sure, we know it's a chapel, and chapels don't have furnaces, and we were in there this morning and we didn't see it, so now we know exactly where it is. So that's what happens.
Now, who may the cardinals actually elect? Is it always from among the cardinal electors?
It's usually from among themselves, but in theory, if you want to go to the level of theory, they're free to choose any male Christian cleric or layman who's baptised and who's not a heretic or in schism or notorious for simony. But we know one thing is for sure: the Pope is elected by a secret ballot and by a majority of 2/3. And after each cardinal writes his vote, he proceeds to the altar, where there's an urn, and he places the vote into the urn. Then the votes are counted by three chosen cardinals who, if you like, act as election officials. And if the number of votes doesn't tally with the number of cardinals present, then the votes are scrapped and they begin again.
Oh, so it always has to be all 115, otherwise it's invalid.
Absolutely. Assuming that the first ballot is inconclusive, they will then vote twice in the morning on the next day and twice in the afternoon on the next day. And if after nine ballots there's still no one chosen, the conclave pauses for not more than a day for some prayer and reflection. And after each inconclusive ballot, this is what the public see on the outside, they see the smoke rising from the chimney. If it's inconclusive, if, in other words, if there's no pope elected, then they will see a dense black smoke. And if the pope is elected, then we'll actually see some white smoke.
And what happens when we do see the white smoke?
Well, after a valid election has brought about a result of 2/3, the cardinal dean asks the newly elected cardinal, do you accept your canonical election as supreme pontiff? And if the one chosen is already a bishop, which of course all cardinals really are, I suppose those electing anyway, he says, I accept. Well, at that very moment when he finishes the last T on the word accept, he immediately becomes Bishop of Rome and Pope. And then he's asked by the Cardinal Dean another question. By what name do you wish to be called? So then the ballot papers and the records are burnt with a different chemical this time, and this produces a white smoke which emerges from the tall chimney, as I said, off the gable wall of the Sistine Chapel. And then people outside, the waiting world, know that someone has been elected Pope, and then they take the Pope aside and they vest him in a white soutane and a scarlet shoulder cape and then a white skull cap or a zucchetto. And the cardinal electors then go to greet him individually, and he's given the gold fisherman's ring, and then a Te Deum, which is a hymn of thanksgiving, is sung. And finally, shortly afterwards, the Pope is then walked across the I suppose it's on the first really floor of the Basilica, it's the Hall of Benedictions, to the main window above the central balcony above St. Peter's, and the windows are opened, and then that's when we see the new Pope for the first time.
And hear the words.
Abemus Papam.
Well, yeah. That'll be another episode, I think, in this series. We still have to wait yet.
May you live in interesting times, as they say.
Well, we certainly have, and we certainly are.
It's true.
Thank you very much for coming in and explaining to us this process between when a pope dies, or in our case, resigns, and the election of the next pope. And we look forward to speaking to you again next week when, who knows, we may have a new pope. Thank you very much, Monsignor John Kennedy.
It's a pleasure, Emma. Thank you.